This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Purzell. Would your spouse, whether a man or a woman, be willing to take a long-distant hike in some of the wildest landscape in the country? Deprive themselves of the comforts of life for days and days, even in the name of a good cause? Local author Jeff Ault will be here later to share stories about his more than 200-mile hike on the John Muir Trail with his wife, Beth. He tells the tales in his new book, Four Boots, One Journey. You'll hear about that later on Cincinnati Edition. But first, from the writer who has brought you Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, who's the pen behind the ethicist column in New York Times Magazine and is liable to pop up just about anywhere with his musings on popular culture, there comes the best-selling book, I Wear the Black Hat. It's now out in paperback. Chuck Klosterman has made quite a career writing about music, sports, and more, and is on the phone from New York to discuss his new book and his grapples with villains, real and imagined. Chuck Klosterman, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Hey, it's good to be on your station.
I was doing background for this interview after having read the book, and I discovered your career included a stop in Ohio, Chuck.
It did. You know, I worked at the Akron Beacon Journal from 1998 to 2002. It's actually where my first book and I guess 90% of my second book were written. And of course, I also at the Beacon Journal, I had a variety of jobs. I was a pop culture writer. I was the film critic for a while. I was a music critic for a while. But I also had, which I think is unique to that publication, I had the roller coaster beat. Because, you know, there's so many new roller coasters. And that included going down to Cincinnati to ride, I believe it was called the Beast.
Oh,
which at the
yes.
time, the second largest wooden roller coaster in the world, or at least that's how it was described to me. I've been to Cincinnati more than once. Yeah.
The roller coaster beat. Now, that I think that is unique to the Beacon Journal there.
And it was great because you would go, you know, you'd go to like Sandusky, Ohio or whatever on media day, which basically meant you and maybe six or seven other reporters could ride the roller coasters an unlimited number of times without any lines to wait for. Because, you know, normally you ride a big roller coaster, you wait in line for about 45 minutes for a 4-minute experience.
Right.
So you can just keep going to the front of the line. It was great. I mean, granted, there wasn't a lot of news. Basically, there was one story about the new roller coasters and then waiting to see if anyone died on them. That was basically the only two stories that you would do.
Well, I've been to Media Day at Kings Island, and I have to say I had a special invitation to ride Son of Beast, which was a wooden roller coaster that was supposed to be the highest wooden roller coaster and included a loop in it. And they put the media on it and let them run for a couple hours, then shut it down because there were some safety issues involved. And I was figuring all they were doing with us media hacks was making sure that, you know, if anybody got killed, it'd just be a reporter from a TV station or something.
Yeah, it's pretty rare, too, to have a loop on a wooden roller coaster. I mean, as kind of a seasoned roller coaster reporter, I know how rare that is because usually those are only on the sort of on the metal contraption. So you really were sort of taking a gamble. So the Son of Beast that's dead now, that's not active.
Yeah, it was. Well, they had some issues in the beginning. It ran for a little while, and then a woman got injured. There were a couple of injuries involved with it. Then they shut it down, and then they tore it down. So that's what happened with the Son of Beast. But the Beast is still there and is still one awesome wooden roller coaster. So, but I digress. I wanted to ask about I Wear the Black Hat. I get it in the hardback version and read it when it came out last year and just smiled and chuckled all the way through it. And to tell you the truth, it really made me think a lot about that concept of a villain. What was the inspiration for this collection of essays? I mean, had you seen a central theme in your writing about villainy developing in your columns?
Well, I think actually the honest answer would be this. You know, one thing I've realized over time, this is the eighth book, I guess, now, is that it is impossible to predict what people are interested in. Like any attempt to write a book with the idea, oh, I think, you know, people want to hear about this subject, or this will be commercially successful or whatever. This is what's happening now. That never works because, you know, people don't know what they want until they see it. It's just it's an impossible thing to predict. So what I do, and this seems strange when I say it out loud, but it's really the only way to do it, is I just write about whatever is interesting to me, and I just hope other people find it equally interesting. Like I just sort of I don't make any attempt to decide what to write about based on anything besides where my literal tangible interests seem to be going. And you know, as I've matured, and I think this is probably a common thing, I'll use maybe a better way to describe it. There's like a three-paragraph or four-paragraph part of the book where I talk about the movie Star Wars. I'm talking about Star Wars with my editor. This is before the book was even written. He had a four-year-old son. Son had just seen Star Wars and kind of blew his mind. And I was mentioning how I've kind of always had this theory that, you know, when you're a real little kid, when you're 7, 8, 9, you see a movie like Star Wars, the character you love is Luke Skywalker. Because he's like purely heroic, he's purely good. If you're out playing Star Wars at recess, that's who everybody wants to be. There's no confusion over what his motives are.
Right.
Then you move into junior high, or maybe high school even. And if you're still interested in the Star Wars movies, and you're especially if you're a guy, the character you start to gravitate toward is Han Solo, who fundamentally is good in the same way that Luke Skywalker is good, but he has the trappings of being bad, the idea of being a criminal or anti-authority. He appears more dangerous, which is how a lot of teenagers want to feel, I think, that they want to feel like they're still good people, but they want the world to perceive them as potentially troubling. But then, you know, you become an adult. Maybe 10 years pass, and maybe you see the movie again, and it's a different movie than you remember because, you know, when you're a kid, it's fundamentally a kid movie, and that's how it works. And when you're an adult, you see it differently. And then you start feeling as though, or at least I started feeling, like the only essential character here was Darth Vader, and that this was the important character. And that if we're going to talk about this narrative outside of just being 2 hours of entertainment, this is the key thing, because as an adult, you realize that people aren't just born evil, that there's factors that make this happen. Some of them are, you know, how you were raised, who your friends are, the choices you make. But just as important is how you are framed by other people, how you are perceived, if you're a public figure, how the media perceives you. And you start feeling, if not necessarily sympathy for Darth Vader, a high degree of empathy or a heightened ability to sort of look at this person and say he's not just this black robotic machine. He's actually a person. Something made this person. And that sort of happened to me in almost every context, as I look at life now, it's difficult for me not to sort of see people who are presented as supposedly or allegedly bad and not sort of question how that decision was made, because so often it seems completely arbitrary.
Well, you put it, you know, I have to say, while I was reading I Wear the Black Hat, that I would follow your line of thought and logic where you, especially where you're talking about villains who are not villains, you know, who should be villains but aren't villains, and people who should not be villains who are villains. And you really had me wavering as a reader as I'm reading this and trying to decide what is good and what is bad. That's pretty hard to nail down.
Well, you know, I'm glad, you know, because it's like I'm glad that makes me feel good as a writer, because my intention is not to persuade people to think a certain way. And I think for most essay writers, that's how it is, that they write because they want sort of the rest of the world to mirror their view of the world. I'm not really like that. I'm not curious, I'm not motivated to make people think like me. I'm just sort of interested in my own experience, rethinking the things that I have unconsciously accepted. And maybe writing helps me understand them. And in theory, somebody who reads that book will go through the same process themselves, quite possibly draw very different conclusions. But just sort of maybe, you know, I'm interested in questions that are so obvious that no one even asks them, because I think that happens a lot.
Yes. Well, you know, another chapter in the book talks about your distaste for the rock group, the Eagles. And I have to say, whenever I tell anybody about this chapter, then most people agree with me. Oh, yeah, they can sing along with all the songs, but they just hate that group. And you talk about other musicians in that same category. But then, you know, you talk about being a critic and all, but there on, I think it's page 35, you say you've lost that ability. You no longer feel that hate of those artists, that the artists you hated are no longer villainous.
Well, because, you know, for many years I was a rock critic, and well, this at the time, it's now very clear to me that in a way, being a music critic is in some ways an extension of how you create a personality when you're in high school, which is that the artists that you like and the artists you dislike are almost used as signifiers for who you're supposed to be and what your worldview is. So there was a time when I really hated the Eagles, and it was for ultimately non-musical reasons, but I would kind of inject those reasons into the music and hear it when I played their songs. In other words, like their songs, which are pretty much inarguably well-designed, well-structured. Every member of the Eagles is a highly musical person. They had very good chemistry as a band. You can't look at those songs and be like, you know, they're just objectively terrible. There's something that makes them feel terrible sometimes, or at least it used to be that way to me, and it was all these other things. So I kind of go in that chapter, I just go through my life, basically starting as a young person, year by year. What bands did I hate? What was my reason? What was my real reason when viewed retrospectively for hating those bands? And it's actually occasionally about the music they produced. But for the most part, it was other things, because if it was just the music, I could have simply not listened to them. You know, it's very easy to ignore pretty much any rock music you want. It's just, it's not that difficult. You can say it's on the radio all the time, but, you know, there's more than one radio station. You know, it's like there's just, right. It's very easy to avoid. So the bands that you hate probably are bands that in some way you love. Like, you know, what you love about them, though, is this emotive feeling of distaste. It sort of gives you an opportunity to sort of funnel that feeling into something that's totally neutral. You know, it's not like taking a political stance or something where whatever your idea is could have like real consequence. It's like a private/public thing whereby hating the Eagles, other people who follow music will know what that means about you, you know? Mm-hmm. And as I got older, I found myself less able to do that. That they started to seem like a ridiculous, kind of absurd practice. And I don't feel that way now when I hear the Eagles. I don't feel those same things. And and as a consequence, I think I'm probably not as good as a critic, because I'm not part of being a critic is sort of being emotionally fragile.
Chuck Klosterman discussing his book, I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined. If you have a question or comment, call 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or get in touch through Facebook or Twitter. You talk about being a critic where you have to be emotionally fragile, and you say if you hate everything, you're a banal a-hole, but if you don't hate anything, you're boring, you're useless, and you end up writing about why you can no longer generate fake feelings that other people digest as real. I thought that was, I see your dilemma there.
It is. It's a strange feeling when you can no longer trust your own thoughts, because you know that your thoughts are not your own. You know that they're a kind of a byproduct of your view of the world and everything else you've ever consumed. Everything else you understand about the world, kind of placed alongside that tiny bit of agency we do have, the tiny bit of actual taste all people possess to like something or dislike something. But as a critic, you always want to pretend that you've broken those things in two, and that you're listening to the record or watching the movie or reading the book or watching the TV show almost in a vacuum, that you're having an autonomous relationship with it. But of course you're not. And this is the same thing that applies to these villains that we talk about, both the ones that are real in the news and the ones that are in fiction. And we think that we're appreciating or judging them based solely on who they are. But that is not the case.
I loved the chapter about Batman, where you talk about Batman and say, imagine you know nothing about Batman, but here's the story that you do know. And I have to say that, you know, you did a good job of walking us through it, because it took me a long time to forget everything I knew about Batman. But then you started talking about Bernard Goetz, the subway shooter, who kind of could be considered kind of a Batman. And it was an eye-opening look at, you know, who our heroes are and who the real villains are.
Well, particularly the idea of the vigilante creates a specific problem for this discussion, because everyone knows, any sophisticated, intelligent person knows, that if you ask them, you know, is vigilantism acceptable? Is it acceptable for people to take the law into their own hands? Well, of course they know. Okay. But when the Bernard Goetz incident happened in the early 1980s, where a guy's on the subway, and, you know, New York is just kind of really at its nadir point. It's kind of a cesspool of crime, and everybody knows that it's a dangerous place to live. And this guy's on the subway, and he's confronted by three teenagers with supposedly sharpened screwdrivers, kind of essentially trying to mug him. And he's like, "You're not going to mug me. In fact, I got this gun." Bang, bang, bang. Shoots these guys. Flees. Well, in the first 24 or 48 hours after that incident, the response was almost universally positive, because people didn't know anything. All they knew is that a guy who was a victim of crime was no longer a victim, that he turned the tables on this, and that maybe he represented what many people in New York secretly wished was the norm. You know, even though these same people, if you had asked them about vigilantism 2 days ago, would have said, of course, it's bad. Now they see it in action, and they're like, this is great. Well, then finally, Bernard Goetz turns himself in, and we start learning details about his life. And he isn't the person society was hoping for.
Right.
He seems to show no remorse. He doesn't look the right way. He says things like, you know, shooting those kids was easier than typing, which is a very strange way to describe it. You know, it's like, and it's all swung back the other way. Now we actually saw the vigilante, and we knew these things about him. It didn't go, it was no longer an idea. Now it was actually a person. So it goes from being something no one accepts to something everyone likes to something no one accepts again. It's a strange deal. It's like the more you learn about a vigilante, the less likely you are to appreciate them.
Well, I know that, you know, part of your notoriety, Chuck, is because there are so many people, as I saw one columnist write, who love to hate you. But, you know, that happens with people who tell the truth too well at times anyhow. But the book now out in paperback after that successful hardcover run. You know, what did you encounter when you went out on tour on the road promoting the book, I Wear the Black Hat?
Well,
I mean, did you get any pushback for it, saying, you know, what, how could you, you know, compare Bernard Goetz to Batman? Why, you know, Muhammad Ali? You know, there's many things I think that would set people off.
Some people did ask me about the Muhammad Ali thing, because that is, you know, he's a very, very difficult person to criticize. And I know that going in, and I'm really criticizing one aspect of his life and not saying that he was a villain, but he had this one episode that seems to be forgotten, like collectively got forgotten by history. For the most part, though, you know, if I go to a book reading, the people who are going there, for the most part, are already kind of psychologically on the side of what I'm doing. Like, they're interested in this work. The main thing I remember is that I was on tour during the George Zimmerman situation. So, of course, I was getting lots of questions about that vigilantism. I mean, because it was happening in the news, you know.
And do you find – it seems that there are conundrums when it comes to this. Like you said with the Goetz story, how at first people were applauding the vigilante, then they learned who the vigilante was, and they, you know, didn't like him very much, so the pendulum swung the other way. And that happens quite often with a lot of the folks that you talk about in the book, I Wear the Black Hat.
Oh, it's – I mean, the main thing that when I write about culture, what I'm really writing about is how it is mediated. Because now we're at a point where the media is not in any way reflecting reality. It is shaping reality in a way that is undeniable. And this has always been the case, but it's gotten more and more amplified as media has increased and people's reliance on it has increased. So when I'm, you know, whenever I'm talking about something and I'm talking about, how this person is seen, what I'm really saying is this is how this person has been designed to be seen. And you may not accept that. You know, you may already agree with me or disagree with me, whatever the case may be. But the imaginations of our culture are trying to, you know, I guess it comes down to this. You know, it's like, how do we understand problems? We have been pretty much socialized to, in America at least, and really all of Western culture, has been socialized to understand problems through narrative, through storytelling. That if you're trying to figure out what's going on, in Gaza right now or in Ferguson, Missouri, wherever the case may be, if you're trying to understand this, the way it's relayed to you is through kind of classic narrative techniques, almost like a fairy tale, which necessitates that there be antagonists and protagonists. So we've already created this system that necessitates the existence of villains. But that's unfair. I mean, it's unfair that just because the only way we can understand problems is through a story, that somebody has to fulfill the role of the story of being the bad guy.
Out of all that you're involved with, you know, as you mentioned, you've written 8 books, you've written about music and sports and politics, you do the... You are the ethicist at New York Times Magazine. What do you enjoy the most? I mean, what's easiest for you?
Well, those are 2 different questions. What's easiest probably is essay writing, particularly as it applies to sports. I guess that was maybe the first thing that I did as a journalist was be a sports writer. I feel like my understanding of sports is probably the deepest of all those categories. And the structure of essay writing in all contexts just came very naturally to me. Like I've never had to struggle with how to structure an essay. It just really seems natural. So that's the easiest part. The part I like the best, I guess, is if I'm able to write fiction that I feel is successful, that is the most satisfying. It's those things almost have a relationship. Because essay writing comes naturally, it's less fun. Because fiction writing is harder and therefore more satisfying, it feels like it's more fun when it works. Although strangely, when I'm actually in the middle of either of those things, it's totally reversed. Like when I'm writing an essay, it feels really great because it's just kind of coming out. But you're always trying to find something that's a little more difficult than what you're able to do, I think. I think that's the goal of, that's just sort of, you're almost inevitably, if you're a creative person in any way, you're trying to find a situation that is just slightly beyond your ability. Because then I guess this is who I am. That it shows you what your limitations are.
Well, I want to, but before I have to let you go, to ask about writing as the ethicist in New York Times Magazine. I imagine that can be fascinating, but also frustrating at the same time when you see all these issues that the people bring to your pen.
Well, it is. It's a fun job. I mean, I think that sometimes it seems strange when I say that because I think – people almost hope that I say that it's a real just burden, this emotional and intellectual burden. I mean, it's fun to work through these problems. I find it really interesting. Because the position is called the ethicist, it's such a strange name to name a newspaper column, that I think a certain kind of consumer assumes that if I write something, if someone writes in a problem and I give them an answer, that because I'm the New York Times ethicist, somehow my answer will become kind of the collective ethical, story. And that's just not how it is. I mean, it's still just fundamentally something that's in the newspaper. So I maybe take it – I take the job doing it seriously, but I don't take the outcome as serious as some other people do. I know that, if somebody – ask me about whether or not they should get elective surgery, and I say yes, it's like, I don't have to perform the surgery. It's like, you ask me as a detached, objective person if it's ethically rational to do this, and I'll tell you yes or no. But, that's the advantage somebody in my position has. Or that for the normal person, when they get into an ethical quandary, they're pulled by emotion. Like, they know their mother, they know their sister-in-law, they know their boss or whatever. They have these feelings, and those feelings cloud their ability to examine it. But, you know, I'm separate from that. So I can just look at it and say, okay, logically, this is how you should behave if you want the greatest utility for everyone involved.
I have to say, a lot of times when I read your answers as the ethicist, I think, boy, that letter writer, if they just thought about it for a little while, could figure it out on their own. But it's nice to have you explaining it, Chuck. So. Well, thanks for your time today, Chuck. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Chuck Klosterman, his book, I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined, is now in bookstores and paperback. More about Chuck and his work, available at WVXU.org. Four Boots, One Journey. Local writer Jeff Ault, straight ahead on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7.